It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. You know that mind twist that you can do where you go from feeling overwhelmed by what you can't accomplish to flipping it over, and then it becomes this puzzle that's fun to solve? Take kitchen cabinets, for instance. Where is it written that they have to be built in and stuck to the floor? And that unless we've got a pot of money, we have to be stuck with what we've got? Sally Schneider turns this idea around. Now, she thinks way beyond the usual HGTV fix. And it works, whether you rent or you own. So, stick around for ingenuity and some new ideas this hour on The Splendid Table. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and supported by Just Bare Chicken. All natural with no antibiotics, vegetable-fed, cage-free, traceable to the family farm where raised. Just Bare Chicken. Go minimal. You can learn more at justbarechicken.com. Did you know that when you rent an apartment in Europe, it's not unusual to find that the kitchen's empty? And I mean literally empty to the walls, because people often take their cabinets with them. Now, granted, this isn't an American concept, but maybe it should be. Sally Schneider, who's creator of the Improvised Life website, goes one better with this idea. Hey, Sally, welcome.
Hi, Lynn. Great to be here.
So tell me, what did you find out when you started digging into this question of movable cabinets?
Well, the best thing I've stumbled on recently is a designer from England named Pascal Anson. He's a young guy who really thinks out of the box, and he did this 2-minute video of his kitchen, which was variously stacked cabinets in this really interesting design with all these different kinds of doors. And Pascal explained his research was that the cabinet part, the box part of a cabinet, is the cheap part. And those are easy to pick up. That's the part that's basically a three-sided box with shelves.
Right.
Where the manufacturers make their money is with the doors, and that's where things get expensive. So Pascal bought a bunch of different cabinets in different sizes without the doors and arranged them in a really unique configuration, some of them stacked as many as three high. And then he went to IKEA's sale department and bought all these different kinds of doors for $2 and $3 each. And as he says, if you're going to do this, you really have to do it. You really have to take it to an extreme, or it will look like you kind of didn't get your doors together. But he's put all these different kinds of doors on these cabinets, and it looks fabulous and stylish and really fun.
Now, are these cabinets, though, are they going to be movable for him?
Well, that's the whole point, Lynn. In Europe, it's very common for you, as you said, you have to bring your kitchen with you. And when you go, you take it with you. Cabinets are modular, which is something I discovered 22 years ago when I designed a kitchen for a place I thought I'd be in forever. And not only designing it, but seeing how it was installed made me realize when I suddenly had to leave the place that I could take my cabinets with me. The top cabinets are basically simply bolted to the wall,
right,
and the bottom cabinets are held in place by a countertop. So easy to come apart. And what I did was I moved to a place with a smaller kitchen. I put the cabinets I could in that kitchen, reconfiguring them for the space.
Right.
And the cabinets that were left over, I actually made into freestanding furniture.
Explain how you made them freestanding.
Well, I had a couple of wall cabinets that were actually taller than most because I had a high ceiling in the other place. And I put them side by side on the floor, and I put a thick board on top, which I painted the same color of the cabinets, which are wood. I also took two other cabinets and stacked them one on top of the other so that they became a kind of tall storage area.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one really narrow one. It was only about 8 inches deep.
Yeah.
And that has been in the bathroom as a cabinet that I can't tell you how many people remarked on it because it happens to be the perfect size and they have no idea that it's a kitchen cabinet.
Huh. And then, of course, you can change the doors to whatever style you like, right?
You can change the doors if you get doors that are wood of a good design, which you can buy in various places. You have the option of painting them as your life changes, and painting the doors can change them radically. You can also take off those doors and swap in doors that aren't necessarily kitchen cabinets, but that you might find a way to put on top of the base cabinet or, say, two stacked base cabinets mm-hmm. and make something really unique.
Yeah, because I'm just thinking about the, you know, old doors, fences of old wood that you could cut down to size. There's a lot of different ways that you could go with this.
The point is you don't have to be bound by what kitchen designers say. IKEA is a beautiful example of the European way of doing it, and it's probably the most accessible. If you look at IKEA's plans, you can begin to see how different cabinets, even cabinets from another place or, say, from an unpainted furniture place, mm-hmm. can work not only as kitchen storage, but as storage throughout the house.
Very cool. Thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Sally Schneider's site is The Improvised Life. Now, if you're thinking about doing your own cabinets, find more information on the website, splendidtable.org. Sally's ideas bring back a piece of cooking ingenuity I learned from two elderly Italian farmers. They were two sisters. It was a Saturday market in northern Italy, and when I asked their opinions about a cheese, it led us to their family Sunday dinner that they made with, now mind you, two eggs, some flour, a handful of cheese, and a pot of broth, and they fed a whole family on this. They did a sort of main dish soup, a filled pasta soup, like ravioli in broth, but they made it in a way I had never heard of. They rolled out a big sheet of dough, they brushed it with egg, they sprinkled half of it with cheese and some herbs, folded over the other half, sealed the two layers together by running the rolling pin over them, and then they cut the dough into small pieces. Well, I said, I mean, doesn't the cheese leak out? And they came back with, they should leak. That's how you flavor the soup, with bits of cheese and herbs. Well, I worked out a recipe. So for Sunday soup with little cheese pastas, just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, sign up for our free weeknight e-newsletter. And you can download podcasts of the show. I mean, what a deal. It's free. SplendidTable.org. Food lovers, frugality is a competitive sport, a sport that is well known to adventurous food types, as in tracking down the local place where you eat brilliantly for next to nothing. Jane and Michael Stern lead the pack here with their road food website. Hey, Jane, Michael, what's the latest discovery?
The latest discovery is a place in Cape Charles, Virginia, on the Eastern Shore, the nickname of which is Shea Exxon.
Wait a minute. Are you talking gas station?
Yay!
Okay. Yes, I'm
all
talking.
Right. My favorite genre of restaurant.
Gas station cuisine. The real name of the place is Stingrays, and it's the type of gas station restaurant that you could just drive right by and never look twice at. It's a big one. It's a convenience store. It's a boat launch. It's got fuel pumps. It's got all kinds of this and that. But when you walk to the back of the place, there is a really great Eastern Shore restaurant. When I say Eastern Shore restaurant, I mean they serve some of the best versions of, you know, crab imperial, stuffed flounder, fried shrimp, fried oysters. I mean, and I mean like top quality versions, not just good for a gas station versions.
It's such a funny place because when you walk in, there are the ubiquitous, you know, those horrible looking prepackaged honey buns that look like they've been run over by a steamroller.
Yeah.
And corn dogs that have been sitting under the heat lamp for 5 years. And just like the kind of, you know, soul killing food that when you're on the road, you look at and you go, oh, you know, there's nothing to eat here. But as Michael said, keep on walking and get to the back, and you will find not only some of the great seafood, but I thought it was the best sweet potato pie.
Well, there's a reason for that.
Had.
I didn't know this until we ate there, but the Eastern Shore, they grow sweet potatoes on the Eastern Shore. So they make
sweet
potato. Yeah. You see little stands where you can, you know, you can buy bags of sweet potatoes locally grown. And from these sweet potatoes, they make a great sweet potato pie topped with damson plum preserves. And let me tell you, that is one wonderful dessert. Plus, if you go there for breakfast, one of the things you must have, I mean, they have all the great Southern breakfasts with like grits and so forth, but they have, you know, the great ham biscuit where you take a slice of good Virginia country ham and sandwich it in a biscuit.
Mm-hmm.
They make sweet potato biscuits, which combined with the ham is just a totally inspired breakfast sandwich.
Now, if you want to be led in the right direction when you get there, ask for Etta.
Ah, yes.
She was our waitress, and Etta is a font of knowledge about everything concerning stingrays, sweet potatoes, food of that region, and she will walk you through one of the best meals that you've ever had.
And in fact, she told us that, you know, she's been there about 20 years, and she told us the reason stingrays is so good is that many of the people in the kitchen, including the woman who makes the biscuits, has been there 20 years too, and they know how to cook.
You know, there's something about sitting, I gather this is sort of on the water, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
There's something about looking out at the water and they're actually serving something that comes from that water. It's kind of reassuring, I would say. This sounds incredible. It sounds like the kind of place you find in the Carolinas and you know, obviously in Virginia
Absolutely.
As well. Hey, thank you, guys.
All right,
okay,
bye.
Lynn.
Bye.
If you get there before I do this morning.
Jane and Michael Stern's newest creation is the book 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Now, check out their road food finds on the site, splendidtable.org. Coming up, punk rocker to cheesemonger and the milkman cometh. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported in part by Novo Nordisk, committed to changing diabetes through treatments, partnerships, and education. Defeating diabetes is our passion and our business. The piece of geography that is called the Bay Area of Northern California is probably the most politicized food environment we've got. Even so, when a punk rocker named Gordon Edgar answered an ad for a cheese worker at the worker-owned Rainbow Grocery Co-op in San Francisco, he had not a clue of what was waiting in the wings. The story of punk rocker to cheese as a life's work is told in Gordon's book, Cheesemonger, A Life on the Wedge. Gordon, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Gordon, do political stances sort of come with the territory when you're working with cheese?
Well, I think political stances come with the territory when you're working with food, you know, assuming that you have some kind of political analysis first. But I think that, you know, cheese was the specific area I worked in, so of course I wanted to know how it worked politically. You know, there's a big learning curve when I first started. You know, what's the difference between a huge industrialized cheese, well, even what's the difference between a processed cheese from a natural cheese, from a small handmade cheese, and why are they all you know, priced different? How do you tell the differences? Mm-hmm. You know, those kind of issues.
You know, one of the things you mentioned in the book, too, is that you see yourself as an urban interpreter of rural life. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that when customers come in and shop in the store, especially in the Bay Area these days, you know, they want to know the story of their food. They want to know where it comes from. You know, they almost want to be entertained before they're going to buy an expensive piece of cheese. And, you know, that's part of the price. You know, you get a story with your cheese once it's over $20 a pound. But I think that the trick is, you know, you can't tell everything. You know, you try to convey to people how much work goes into cheese, how much effort goes into being a family farmer, for instance. And I think people can come away with a better understanding of that. You know, on the other hand, sometimes people really want to romanticize, you know, the noble farmer. You know, and sometimes that's not really reality either. You know, I'm not saying that people aren't, that dairy farmers aren't good people, but, you know, people make decisions to survive in this economy that has so many farmers going out of business every year. You know, so sometimes people are just, they're appalled at the fact, like, oh, why doesn't this person make their cheese with raw milk instead of pasteurized? Or why don't they grass feed all their animals? You know, and there's a lot of things that go into every farmer's decision. And, you know, some of those are economic decisions, mm-hmm. because if they don't make those economic decisions, they're not going to have a farm next year.
Yeah. Can you give us an example of a cheese that you like that embodies what you've been talking about?
Well, there's a cheese company, not a cheese in particular, but there's a farm up in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont called Jasper Hill. It's a family farm, and the mission of this farm is not just to make great cheese, which they do. The Winnemere that they make is one of my favorite cheeses in the world. It's seasonal. It's wrapped in bark. It's washed with a local lambic beer, and you get the most complex flavor of this in this cheese than pretty much almost any other cheese I've ever tasted. But what's really interesting about this company is what they did was that they invested, along with Cabot Creamery and some other foundation grants, in a huge aging facility. And why is that important? What that means is that their mission is to help save and increase family dairy farming in Vermont. So what they're doing is they're going to these farms and saying, you know, we can age your cheese for you in our facility, which means that those farmers don't have to build that facility, get their own loans, do all that kind of work. But if they make the cheese, they have a place to have it age, mm-hmm. for, you know, whether it's a month or 6 months or a year. And an expert ager, too. In France, you'd call it an affineur, but, you know, it's a cheese ager.
Right.
Who will make sure that cheese can be the best that it can be. And you know, it's a great story. And, you know, basically, if you see anything either made by Jasper Hill Farm or anything that's aged at the cellars in Jasper Hill, then, you know, it's just a fabulous cheese. And I think that one of the important things about, you know, political things about cheese is the reason it's important for farmers is dairy farmers can't control milk prices. Milk prices are set at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. So if they're selling fluid milk, they can go for months selling milk at a loss and kind of hope that later in the year the price will increase and that they'll make money on it. But it's really out of their control, especially as a small dairy farm.
Right.
So if people can make cheese, it's called in the industry a value-added product. And what that means is you've had milk, which has a commodity set price, but you've made it into cheese, which means you can set your own price that can reflect your own costs and can help ensure that your family can stay on the farm. And that's one of the ways that cheese is very political and very important. And that's one of the ways that that Jasper Hill is really helping keep dairy farming alive.
Hmm. Well, thank you, Gordon. Thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you. I love being on the show.
Gordon Edgar's book is Cheesemonger, A Life on the Wedge. Now, try a shortcut approach to homemade mac and cheese with my 21st century mac and cheese. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. Writer Scott Hewler has a story that could put out to pasture that old adage, moderation in all things, and replace it with this: never celebrate tomorrow what you can celebrate today.
Somewhere between the dishwasher and the cupboard shelf, a wine glass breaks. Maybe I swing wide and tap the counter edge. Maybe it's slippery and I just drop it. By the time I sweep up the pieces, I don't even remember. It's not important. Or not to me. If we break a wine glass, my wife cringes, attributing to the glass an importance I don't understand. I believe the opposite. The occasional broken wine glass is a good omen, a sign of life well lived. It means your wine glasses are seeing use, that you're toasting, cleaning, rinsing, dropping. A good thing. I'm no wine snob, but wine means so much to us. We drink it with family and friends, at worship, in celebration. No surprise that at Jewish weddings, we celebrate by breaking a wine glass. Wine flows through our lives like blood through our veins. And so as I sweep up this broken wine glass, I remember a story about not a glass, but a bottle of wine. My friend, novelist Dan Gerino, has told it many times.
When I got married in 1982, one of the gifts my wife and I got was this very nice, expensive bottle of wine. And rather than sort of drink it right then, we saved it. We were going to open it for a special occasion. And, you know, and special occasions kept coming and going. I mean, there was the birth of a child. There was our own first anniversary. There was the birth of a second child. And we kept sort of, none of them quite seemed the really big once-of-a-lifetime kind of special occasion. And others came. When I got my first book published, I thought that would be a special occasion. But, you know, the call you get from your agent, is that the special occasion? Is it when the contract arrives? That's just paperwork. Yeah. So again, there was no perfect special occasion.
Dan used to tell this story at book readings to demonstrate that the life of an author wasn't as filled with celebration as one might think. The times I followed him to the podium, I used to say that the story demonstrated only that Dan Gerino didn't drink enough wine. An easy laugh. Then the story grew more complex.
And then what happened is that at 20 years after getting that bottle of wine, my wife got sick. She had a headache one day and couldn't shake it. And after a while, she went to the doctor, and the doctor found multiple brain tumors. She had metastatic melanoma. 4.5 months after being diagnosed, she died. And I realized there was never going to be a special occasion worthy of that bottle of wine. And I didn't know what to do with it.
Not long thereafter, I myself got married. We broke a wine glass and everyone cried, "Mazel tov! Good luck." Shortly thereafter, Dan and I met for lunch, and he brought a gift in a brown paper bag, a bottle of wine and two glasses.
I decided that the perfect gift would be this bottle of wine and a couple of wine glasses. And that would be part of the gift. The other part of the gift would be that story, with the lesson being that you don't put off that kind of indulgence. Enjoy this with your wife at the first possible opportunity. Take this bottle, take these glasses, and don't make the same mistake I did.
The paper bag was handed from one moist-eyed guy to another, and I brought home the bottle with strict instructions. We were to drink the wine and smash the glasses. Well, we tried. Dan had worried about how well the wine, Chateau Margaux 1978, if you're wondering, worth $200 today, had aged. Suspicious, drippy-looking marks on the neck raised questions, which the first gentle tap of the corkscrew answered. The withered cork dropped instantly into the wine, which had gone horribly bad. The wine went down the drain. The empty bottle moved to the top shelf in my office, a souvenir of something, and the two glasses, unbroken, sat in the back of our cupboard. Marked for their single use, we couldn't defile them with the stuff out of a box we usually drink, but neither could we break them before they had done their job. Fortunately, time goes on, and even despite heartbreak and tragedy, it has been mostly kind. My wife and I have been married now for 3 years, one little boy, and an uncounted number of the cleanup projects that speak of a fortunate life. And so we got to thinking. Dan is doing well. By now he even has a steady girl. To clear out those two unbroken glasses, maybe instead of waiting for a special occasion, we ought to get a new bottle and two more glasses. I went to a wine store to replace that Chateau Margaux. I learned, and spent, a lot more than I planned to, but let's just say I ended up with a Bordeaux from Saint-Estèphe, the slightly lower-rent region right next to Chateau Margaux. We arrived at Dan's house and decanted the wine to let it breathe. But it's a funny thing. We set to eating some Cajun creation of Dan's, and an hour later, okay, we took out the special glasses.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. So happy to.
This is great.
Damn, that's good.
And of course it was good. We drank the whole bottle. Dan took a moment to explain that the custom of smashing a wine glass comes from toasting a bride and destroying the glass so that it may never be used for a less noble purpose, but we never really thought of our own noble purpose. We were just four friends happily killing a few bottles of wine, and that seemed to be purpose enough. Still, we had committed ourselves to using those glasses only once, but who wanted to clean up a mess? So instead of smashing them, we trooped down to the pond at the back of Dan's yard.
One, two, three.
It may never be used for a less noble purpose. Unless somebody's going to wade out there and get them.
I suppose this means we've all learned Dan's lesson, that the best honor you can give a bottle of wine is to drink it. And I hope a little of my own lesson comes along, too, that the wine glass means less than the wine that's in it, and they both mean less than the hand holding it. And when a wine glass sees its final use, whether you drop it, crush it underfoot, or fling it into the pond, you should always remember, it's good luck. Mazel tov.
Writer Scott Hewler is author of On the Grid: A Plot of Land, An Average Neighborhood, and the Systems That Make Our World Work. Maybe you've spotted the free magazine. It's called Edible. Now, this is a different sort of food magazine. In 2004, Tracy Ryder and Carol Topalian had an idea for a magazine of stories on their local food people, you know, the farmers, the artisans, the ranchers. And it caught on. And then a brainstorm hit. Why not do that locally all over the country? In 6 years, Edible magazines have started in 65 parts of the country. Now, the stories are collected in a book, Edible: A Celebration of Local Foods, and Tracy joins us from Santa Fe. Hey, Tracy, welcome.
Hi, Lynn. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. You know, until I saw this book, I had thought that the milkman had kind of, you know, disappeared off the map. But evidently, that's not so.
That's right. It is not so. And interestingly, in Monroe County, Michigan, is the Calder Dairy, who is a three-generation family making wonderful local dairy products and still delivering milk to homes in the area. And we're seeing this in Northern California. We see it even in the heart of Manhattan. There's a Manhattan Milk Company that's delivering to homes. There's a big Mr. Milkman in Pennsylvania. It's we just learned that it's in Washington, D.C., in the inner city, and you know, that it really is being used.
Okay, but how do they compete with supermarkets? You know, milk is famous for being so low priced that the farmer can't make a living, you know, doing milk. So how are they managing?
Well, you know, these are really smart folks who are in these businesses today, and they come up with really creative ideas to be profitable and make their companies sustainable. They've extended their product lines. And, you know, the quality of the milk, people tell us all the time at Edible Communities that they are willing to pay a little bit more for a product that they know where it comes from mm-hmm. and that it's made in their neighborhood. So being able to have a milk delivered to their homes, even if it's a dollar or so more, they're willing to pay it because they know the farmer, you know, they know the cows who created it.
You know, I remember reading about the Calders. They have only 100 cows.
That's right, 100 cows.
That's doing an awful lot with 100 cows.
I think it is. I agree. When I grew up, we actually lived next door to a dairy farm that had about 350 head of cattle, and they used to have to cross the road twice a day to get into the milking barn. And, you know, I remember how long it took if you were trying to go somewhere to wait for those cows to cross the road. So, but I always thought it took 300 or 400 head of cattle to be able to have a thriving dairy business, and I'm happy to learn that you can do it on 100 head instead.
Tracy, talking about what the Calders do with 100 cows starts you down the path of those of us who have never farmed. I think we really romanticize it.
You're right. I think that is romanticized a lot by people. And many consumers today probably don't realize just how difficult this is, what a difficult choice it is for a family, you know, to say this is what we're going to do and this is how we're going to earn our living.
Yeah. Because, you know, what I'm thinking is that in so many cases with farming families, someone has to have a job outside of the farm.
That's right.
And just the idea that a farm isn't necessarily successful enough generally to support a family for any long period of time. Are you finding that often or are you finding the opposite?
No, we find that often. I can't tell you how many interviews I've done with farmers around the country who say, you know, my wife has a job in town now just because we need, you know, to have health insurance. And, you know, they're so dependent on water and climate conditions. I mean, you know, in Iowa 2 summers ago, the entire state was underwater from the big flood. And, you know, farmers, you know, they're susceptible to so many things that can affect them. You know, it's really not only tough, hard work, but so dependent on so many factors outside of their control.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Tracy, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Lynn. My pleasure.
Tracy Ryder is co-author of Edible, A Celebration of Local Foods. Now, there's a recipe in the book that's a tribute to the milkmen of the world, caramel ice cream with caramel sauce and fleur de sel. And it's on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, take a look at the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, at a dinner party in 18th century France, what might you find your wine glass in? We're going to have that answer in a moment. And we're going to be talking to you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a moment. You can join us at 800-537-5252 or go online. splendidtable.org. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, at a dinner party in 18th century France, what might you find your wine glasses in? Well, the glass could have been tipped into what's called a wine rinser. These were deep glass bowls, the size of a soup bowl, with lips on opposing sides of the rim, and they always had water in them. Wine glasses were much smaller then, and they were expensive, so usually hosts didn't have a glass for each wine. So they put out wine rinsers. You'd rinse your glass between wines by turning it upside down into the water and hooking its foot on the lip. Well, today wine rinsers are major collectibles for wine types. The oldest one I've seen is from England in the mid-1700s. But that started me thinking, and it started a little detective work. And sure enough, the French beat out the English. They were rinsing their wine glasses in 1735, and there is a painting to prove it. It's called The Oyster Lunch, and it's a party painting. A bunch of young men are dressed in the 1735 equivalent of Dolce & Gabbana. They're lounging around a big table with platters of oysters and glasses tipped into water bowls. My proof. But something else is happening in the painting that's given it importance. everyone is looking up, and you have to look very closely to see why. There's a servant at the table, and he's just opened a bottle. This bottle was to become the choicest drink in France. It was champagne, and everybody is watching the cork shoot for the ceiling. This picture is the first picture of champagne being served in France. But for geeks like me, the painting is still all about the wine rinser.
Hello? Hey, what's going on? How come I never see you around no more? Where you been? Yeah, well, you should call me. When? Well, I get all my messages. I never got any from you.
The lines are open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or go online, splendidtable.org. Just shoot us an email. Anything goes. Okay, let's see who is up. We have got Anne calling from Minneapolis. Anne, what do you want to talk about?
I want to expand my repertoire of bean recipes.
Ah, okay. All right. So what are you thinking specifically?
Well, I've been monkeying with some recipes, and the only thing I've had success with so far is hummus. Some recipes are just very bland.
Uh-huh.
And when I've gone to the more ethnic ones, they seem to use a lot of heavy spices. And I can work that direction, but mm-hmm. I have two kids, so we need a nice transition.
Okay, a couple of things come to mind. Do your children like tomato sauce and pasta?
Yes.
Okay. There's a wonderful dish that comes out of Italy, and it's essentially, it translates as beans in the style of little birds. And essentially what it is you make a tomato sauce, and you take cooked beans, and you add them to that sauce, and you simmer them. And the sauce should be in a quantity that it's clinging to the beans, but they're not drowning in it.
Okay.
And you eat that with a salad. It is so good. Those warm beans, and it could be pinto beans. It could be black beans. It could be chickpeas. These are all beans with great flavor. So that's one approach to take. Another approach is that if you want to do dried beans from scratch.
You usually do.
Well, what you do is saute celery, carrot, and onion and garlic in olive oil first in the pan.
And okay, then, that's the standard here.
Yeah, and then add the drained, soaked beans and cook them. And add salt to the pan. You want to salt them from the beginning. Don't believe this business about you salt beans at the end. It's ridiculous. And that's going to already give the beans some flavor, a lot of flavor. Now, from there, you can take that and you can add to it all kinds of delicious vegetables, and you end up with sort of a vegetable stew. I do a variety of beans initially, so I might do three beans that I'm cooking together. And then what I'll do is I'll add corn to that. I'll add greens to that. You can add zucchini. You can add sweet peppers. And you let that simmer, and you throw lots of soft herbs. What I'm thinking about is basil or a little bit of thyme, that kind of thing, and you end up with this great bean stew. And you put, okay. That would be delicious. And if you want to serve that with a hunk of cornbread, you're going to be over the moon.
That's popular here, too.
Right. And the idea, too, is there you get the complete protein. Because, you know, when you do grains and beans, you get a complete protein.
Yes, you get more than you would with just beans.
Exactly. And this is not necessarily resorting to heavy spicing. So look to the Mediterranean for spicing. You know, look at France, look at Italy, look at Greece, look at the Eastern Mediterranean, all the Arab countries. That's where you're going to find some of the great ideas of what to do with the beans and some of the beans you might want to use. So give it a shot. See how the kids react.
I'm sure it'll be just fine. They're wonderful eaters.
Oh, that's
been a thrill to talk with you. Thank you.
Well, thank you for calling. Take care, Anne. Bye.
Bye-bye.
You can reach us 800-537-5252 or go to the website, splendidtable.org. We've got Dan calling from Edwardsburg, Michigan. Dan, welcome.
Hi, Lynn.
What do you want to talk about?
Well, I want to talk about beef. I was inspired by the segment I heard on an earlier program where you were interviewing Stephen Rennell in his book and his account of hunting bison in Alaska.
Right, yes.
And I'm not in Alaska. I'm in Southwest Michigan. But we moved here a couple of years ago after living in Westchester County, New York, two blocks from the Starbucks.
And this is quite a change, isn't it?
We expanded our horizons a little bit, and now we have 10 acres. And we purchased this property from some horse lovers, and it has a barn and some pasture. And we mm-hmm. thought, well, what are we going to do with this? And we eventually decided to get some Angus, and we raised some Angus during the last season from calves, and then had them butchered and sold some, and we have a freezer full of Angus meat. And so the question I have is, and I just love this beef, because the butcher aged it nicely.
Oh, that's
for
great.
2 or 3 weeks, and even though it's been frozen in the freezer, it just seems like you can't do anything wrong with it. It's always tender and delicious. But I could use some advice on, when I'm grilling steaks, how can I tell that they're done without, you know, cutting it in half
and looking at it
and making a mess out of it?
Okay, I think there's two ways of doing it. One is by touch. Okay, if you press the meat when it's raw, okay, you know that one a little firmer than that is very, very rare.
Okay.
As it gets firmer and firmer, it's getting more and more done. So, but the safe way, the way I like to do it, is using an instant reading thermometer. It makes a little hole. And, you know, meat is not a balloon, that if you make a hole in it, you're going to lose all the juice.
Yeah.
People say you should never puncture it. No, you don't want to puncture it constantly. But the reality is that all those delicious juices are in little tiny cells. So it's not a big deal. But this is the two things about getting it the way you really want it. Number one is, have a fire that has high heat and low heat. In so many words, if you're using coals, you'd have a double layer of coals over on one half of the grill, and you'd have maybe a quadruple layer on the other half. So on the high end, or a high burner and a low burner if you've got a gas grill, on the high end is where you're going to kind of sear the meat when it first goes on the grill. And then you want to cook it really slow, because that's how you're going to get even doneness from top to bottom. And what you would do is, an instant reading thermometer goes into the center of the steak. And if you want very rare, you want it to be at 125. And then when you take the meat off the grill, and this is true of any meat that you cook, from any animal, let it rest 10 to 15. Yeah, because first of all, it's going to go up about 5 degrees. Secondly, all the juices settle. It's almost as though it kind of collects itself. If you cut into it right after it comes off the grill, all the juices run out. And it's chewy, and it doesn't taste good. You let it rest 10 to 15 minutes, and it's a completely different experience. So 125 is very rare. 130 to 135 is heading from rare to medium rare. 135, now this is knowing that it's going to go up another 5 degrees or so once it rests, okay? So if you take it off at 140 to 145, you're heading from medium rare into medium. And I would say beyond that, it's not worth cooking the steak and eating it.
Yeah.
I mean, but again, it's all personal taste. But that instant reading thermometer will give you a reading literally in seconds. It is the most dependable way to know where your meat is. And generally, you figure about 6 to 8 minutes to the side if you're doing it low and slow, which is the way I think you're going to get the juiciest, most delicious, you know, rendition of your steak. How do you like your steaks normally?
I usually like them medium rare.
Okay, so you want 130, 135 or so. Okay. So I would say that's going to be 10 minutes to the side if you're doing it low and slow. I mean, it depends. And by the way, if the steaks are cold, they take longer to cook,
right,
but then you have more control.
I usually try to get them up to room temp before.
They're going to cook faster, and so it's going to be less time.
Okay.
Okay?
All right.
Enjoy that meat.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. Take care.
You too.
Bye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or go online, splendidtable.org. We got an email from Paul in Georgia who asks if I have any sources for unusual and ethnic ingredients for those who live in rural areas. Okay, Paul, I can tell you some sources I've used firsthand that
I've found more than satisfactory. Some are quite exceptional. For Spanish ingredients, latienda.com and the Spanish Table. For general European / Mediterranean ingredients, Zingerman's, which is zingermans.com. Expensive, but the quality is pretty swell. For great spices, I think exceptional spices, Penzies. And another source is Savory Spice. Savory Spice is based in Denver. Then you have some others that I've heard of, but I have not tried them personally. Okay. One of them, by the way, is CajunGrocer.com. That's pretty obvious. And then King Arthur Flour has a very good reputation for anything to do with baking, equipment, ingredients, etc. And then there's one other thing to do. When you find an ethnic book you want to try recipes from, usually at the back of the book, the author is going to offer sources. Check them out. All right? Thanks a lot. Call us, 800-537-5252, or send us an email, splendidtable.org. We've got Judy calling from St. Louis. Hey, Judy, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. A few weeks ago, my beautiful aunt Charlotte passed away.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And she was a great cook. She was kind of the center of that part of the family.
Uh-huh.
She loved people. She loved new recipes. She collected tons and tons of recipes. And after the funeral, we're all gathered at my cousin's house, and somebody asked about her recipe box. Well, she had a couple of them, and we ended up with one. And my sister took on the task of, you know, putting this all into a cookbook.
What a wonderful tribute to her.
Yeah, and it's been kind of fun looking through the book because there are recipes that she had. There are recipes that she got out of the paper.
Mm-hmm.
She had a little system of writing up in the corner where she got it, you know, DDD for the local newspaper.
Right.
And, you know, other magazines and then there's some recipes in there that we had shared with her. So, you know, a lot of them are in our handwriting, her handwriting.
Right.
Yeah, you know,
right.
My mother's handwriting.
It's a record of life.
Yeah. Exactly.
Do you know in Thailand that when people died, they would have what they called funeral books, and it would be all about their lives and often recipes for their dishes that they loved.
Oh, that's fabulous.
It was a way of preserving the spirit of the person, and they would be shared with, I guess, loved ones or the immediate family. So it's the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
So what do you have a question?
Well, what's the best way to keep this all together? I mean, I know there are companies that will put cookbooks together for church groups and that sort of thing. But I think we just like to share it among the family.
Yeah,
is there a way to do it electronically?
I'm not the most sophisticated person electronically. So, you know, this may be the blind leading the blind, Judy. But this is my thought. You'd want to see, for me, and I would imagine just from what you're describing, mm-hmm. part of the experience is seeing the original recipe in whatever form it was. So maybe what would be kind of cool would be scan the recipe, mm-hmm. right? And then put the cookbook together with the original recipe on one page. And if you think it's necessary, type the recipe on the other page. So it's easier to read, or just the original recipe, if it's clear. Now, what you might want to add once you've done the scanning is memories from people in the family of sharing that dish, seeing her make it, whatever that dish connects to, you know, the Thanksgiving ritual, whatever it is, and short notes. And it may be a collection of almost, you know, like bullet points, but short quotes or short notes, or if they're longer, they're longer, but with the name of the person and a date.
Very good.
And so now what you've got is a family diary that is the life of your aunt who you love so much. But now it's tying the family together. And I think you can learn very quickly how to self-publish that online.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to be hard to do. But I think it would be lovely to keep that original recipe as the main part of what this publication is and then the links that you all feel to it.
Right.
And it could be very specific experiences with it. It could be memories. It could just be feelings.
Yeah.
And get everybody represented one way or another.
Okay. Yeah.
But I think scanning that recipe is going to be one of the keys in that way. And then you can pass this around to everybody and they can add their own bits and pieces to it. I mean, it could become a living document that keeps changing and growing.
Yeah, that would be great. And then, you know, if we did it online, people could do it from wherever they are.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
You wouldn't have to go, you know, to this end of the country and that end of the country.
Exactly. As much fun as that might be.
Right.
And
right.
Then, of course, what would be wonderful is that when you decide you're all going to hit print and print it up, you have a family reunion, and everybody makes one of your aunt's dishes.
Oh, yeah, that's
great. And you celebrate the publishing of your personal book of your family.
I love it.
Yeah. Hey, Judy, good luck with this.
Well, thank you very much, Lynn.
And thank you.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. You can reach us, 800-537-5252, or send us an email, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. That's the number, 800-537-5252. You have a great week, and let me leave you with this thought from Oscar Wilde, who said, "The cynic knows the price of everything, but the value of nothing." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. Now, you're going to find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. And also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau and Jennifer Larson. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Brett Baldwin. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.